This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So, given the limited time, I asked myself a question: what do Arakawa and Gins leave out? And the question I came up with was animals. But why animals? I want to contend that at this point in human history, animals have become very important, precisely because of our various cultures, with whatever human-animal distinctions they presume, are challenged by the new biologies which suddenly call into question our position within the animal world. And this is particularly critical for Western culture, which has tended to maximize a vast difference between humans and animals. Thus, when we discover that genetically we're only a percentage point plus different from the chimpanzees, and that we share at least a third of our genes with C. elegans, the favorite worm for experiments, we must begin to wonder. And here philosophers have not been much better than the now outmoded scientists who once held dominantly to a mechanical and/or behaviorist model for animals. The exception is Donna Haraway, the same feminist technoscience thinker who proposed the Cyborg Manifesto in the 80s. She claimed we're all hybrids, and when maximalized, can contain human, animal, and technological parts. I know of the human and technological parts. I don't yet have an animal part. However, Haraway now proposes a new manifesto, the Companion Species Manifesto, which shifts the ground more towards the animal. We as embodied beings are also animal colonies, from the bacteria in our guts to the parasites such as fleas, which colonize us specifically, different fleas inhabiting hair, but others, artifacts, and clothes, which harbor different species of fleas, to viruses at the micro level, or the factory farm colonized chickens, which we eat. Our companion species are constantly with us, even if totally unnoticed. Those we do notice, I suspect, are most frequently pets. Just a year ago, my wife and I purchased a co-op in Manhattan, and one of our questions the co-op board asked us is, do you have any pets? The answer is yes. We have Kafka. There he is. We have Kafka, our very large Maine Coon cat. He's just small enough not to exceed the pet weight limit for dogs in our building, i.e. 20 pounds. And when we finally got all settled, we could not help but notice how full the building was with cats and dogs, the latter of which we meet frequently on the elevator on their way out to walk or play in the small dog area of Carl Schurz Park. The city is full of pets, companion species. And philosophers sometimes have had cats, and sometimes even reflect upon them, as Martin Buber in I and Thou. When in a brief glimpse he recognized that his cat was seeing him, he got a glimpse of an I-Thou with a non-human being. My cat allows me to meet him in the morning by literally letting me put my nose to his nose and without blinking one bit. Or there's Jacques Derrida, stepping from his shower and finding his cat looking at him, making Derrida become suddenly aware of his nakedness. Or so Derrida, only reflecting on Derrida. Neither of these typical cat-human instantaneous glimpses are like the penetrating and very long-sustained eye-to-eye experiences with Kafka, who, unlike any cats in my experience, continued to hold me in his gaze. Who is this cat being? But then, what does this have to do with Arakawa and Gins? More, I think, than they might imagine. My assignment is related to landing sites. Now, perhaps because they're very deeply urban persons, or perhaps because the focus of so much of their work on architectural bodies, surrounds, and interactions are with artifactual constructions, they're still lacking a kind of animal, specifically, for purposes here, a cat. Now look at the building site drawing. What Arakawa and Gins do is to constantly challenge sedimented, habitual, even sclerotized habits, including motile ones. The uneven terrain of the landing site depicted also echoed in Bioskleve House, with its undulating floors and disruptive perspectives, calls for a kind of new practice of motion, including what could be called practiced falling. Remember the experiment of the fall from the Empire State Building described in their literary work. Now, one practice which forefronts precisely this practiced falling turns out to be some variants of Asian martial arts. My son Mark, fond of these arts, for a while was going to a jiu-jitsu place this fall, and the first lessons were all precisely those which taught him how to fall. I recalled again the ANG landing site drawing, but where the cat? From the early days of time-stop photography, here we see how a cat can, even if held upside down and dropped from a not too high a distance, rights itself midair and lands on its feet. Actually, this exquisite feat, which calls for a keen sense of balance and up and down directionality, can be performed by quite a few animals, including geckos, who are able to use their tails to do an aid to a righting movement. I've actually been studying self-righting animals, and I was very surprised to learn that cats, even when they jump or fall from a building as high as 32 feet, almost always survive. 32 stories almost always survive. What seems to happen is this. They reach terminal velocity, which, given Galileo's laws of motion, is the same as our terminal velocity. But then they, by that time, are righted, and they stretch out their legs and fall into a relaxed position. And once in a while, they'll break their leg or something, but they get up and walk away from a 32-story fall. And it occurred to me that unlike me, with my aging osteoarthritic bones, or even Mark, whose early practice falls left him with bruises, that the gracile, agile cat can land on a site and walk away with cat aloofness. Now, would it be ironic to suggest that in spite of the absence of the animal, Arakawa and Ginz have actually designed landing sites for cats? Or is the implication that were we more cat-like, it would be easier to inhabit such an architectural surround? Is the suggestion parallel to the organism which persons, that could also be the organism which felines? But I don't want to leave the meditation in this ironic state. Rather, I want to suggest something deeper and more prolonged for our reflective task. As I accommodate to Manhattan life, watching sometimes with humor the anthropomorphizing of so many street-walking dogs with their sometimes strange hairdos, home-knitted sweaters, and even sunglasses, I like to think of a time back now more than a half century ago to boyhood on my father's farm. There, too, were animals, both pets and the usual variety of domestic old McDonald's farm creatures, as well as an assortment of wild animals in the fields and hedgerows. Yet, while the variety was greater and the cutesy urban anthropomorphism was absent, I have begun to realize that even the rural variation does not yet transcend our cultural human-animal divide. Rather, closer to transgressing the divide are two new and often shocking paradigm shifts which have begun to take shape amongst animal ethologists. These shifts could be called, on the one hand, an animal theory of mind, and on the other, the recognition of animal cultures. Now, the reason I have followed these new trends, in part, is because of my interest in the philosophy of technology. There's a growing recognition of the animal use of tools and even of the design and manufacture of tools. Indeed, today, primate ethologists have identified 27 distinct chimpanzee cultures, largely by virtues of the tools that they make and the practices to which they put them. This includes distinctive tools in other groups as well, for example, corvids, crows, rooks, and ravens. And they have shown that they can make and design tools in the wild from stiff-stemmed leaves, but do even better when given wire to shape into grub-catching hooks. And even one subgroup of dolphins have learned to use sponges on their beaks when foraging for buried shellfish so as not to injure themselves. As investigations spread and paradigms become reinforced with new observations, we find so many animals who are more like us than our history has allowed. But the question is also, can we, could we, or should we also learn to be more like them? Thank you.